rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, podcast at Apple iTunes. Welcome back to our program on this 31st of August. It's Wednesday, in fact, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's Wednesday. When members of the Louisiana National Guard left for Iraq in October. Now, this is a story dated Dateline August 1 from the Times-Picayune of New Orleans. When members from 4 weeks ago, when members of the Louisiana National Guard left for Iraq in October, they took a lot of equipment with them, dozens of high water vehicles, Humvees, refuelers, and generators are now abroad. And in the event of a natural disaster, that could be a problem. Lieutenant Colonel Pete Schneider of the Louisiana National Guard says the National Guard needs that equipment here at home to support the Homeland Security mission. But it's in Iraq. Now, that's heartbreaking enough. Can it get any worse? The terrible tragedies that are happening, compounded by the incredible incompetence of the Bush administration, moving our disaster relief equipment out of Louisiana and into Iraq so that George W. could have his war so he could gain political capital. Well, to make things even worse, could it be that Hurricane Katrina didn't even really need to happen? Ross Gelspan is with us. He's the author of The Heat Is On. His website, heatisonline.com. Is that .com or .org, Ross?
.org, Tom.
.org, thank you. Heatisonline.org. In fact, I've got it here on my computer, but I got about three screens burying it right now. And, Ross, you are absolutely brilliant. Been on the program before. I loved your book when I read it some years ago when it first came out. I know that there's a new updated edition out. And the Reich Wing has just been going off on this thing. There's no global warming. This has got nothing. I think that they see this as an Achilles heel for George W. Bush. Could that be why Limbaugh devoted half his program to this yesterday?
It could very well be, Tom. Actually, just to put in a plug, I've got a new book out that's called Boiling Point, and it's coming out in paperback next month, and it deals a lot with the Bush administration and the influence of big coal and big oil on the White House. We basically say the White House has become the East Coast branch office for ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal. And so there's no question about the fact that this is creating large problems for the president, given his dismissal of the whole issue of climate change throughout.
Why is the American press treating this in such a cavalier fashion? There's been, just to put it in context, I was in Australia a few years ago when they were having the fires that came right up against the edge of Sydney. And I was in Sydney watching ABC, Australian Broadcasting Corporation, national news, and the weather guy comes on, and he says, well, because of climate change, because of global warming, we can expect that this part of the country is going to see more fires over the coming years, and this part of the country is going to be a little drier, and over here we're going to have a little extra rain. And he's just very matter of fact. I was in England about, I don't know, 3 years ago, the year that autumn, that November, when they had the 60-mile-an-hour sustained winds that had never before happened. I had to fly in through that stuff. And again, on the weather, they were just talking about, well, you know, this is the consequence of global climate change. Everybody in the world is talking about this in a matter-of-fact fashion. Our media is not even talking about it, much less talking about it in a matter-of-fact fashion. Why?
That is so really true. It's absolutely true. Even the Financial Times that I happen to get has articles about climate change three times a week, whether it's about carbon trading or whatever.
Right, and the Financial Times is like the right-wing business paper of England.
The Journal of Britain, basically, and I think what we're seeing in the U.S. press is a consequence of a very, very sustained campaign of deception and disinformation and intimidation by the fossil fuel lobby. So it was a fact that when reporters and editors were doing stories about climate change a few years ago, the fossil fuel lobby PR specialists would be on the phone with some of their greenhouse skeptics, forcing the reporter to write this in a balanced way as the he said, she said story. And as a result, the public sort of shrugged and said, you know, when you make up your mind, know what you're talking about, come back to us. And they've done a really good job in marginalizing this issue in the press. And what they've done, I think, if I can take just a minute here, is they've really exploited the ethic of journalistic balance by invoking it in this area. Balance comes into play when you're writing a story about opinion, okay? Should we have gay marriage? Should abortion be legal? Should we have a war in Iraq? When it's a question of opinion, a reporter is obligated to give the major competing viewpoints their best shot, their most articulate presentation. But when it's a question of fact, it's up to a reporter to get off his or her butt and find out what the facts are. And in the case of climate change, what we know about the climate comes from more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. So what you're seeing in the failure of the press is really the legacy of a very, very clever operation by the public relations specialists of Big Coal and Big Oil.
Well, it's still ongoing. On my local, I do a local program as well in Portland, Oregon, that's on the air before this national program. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed the state climatologist here in Oregon a couple of days ago, and he's like, oh, there's no climate change, or to the extent that there is, it's a natural phenomenon. Humans aren't influencing it. And I'm like, what? You know, this guy, and he's quoted by the right-wingers in Congress and things. You know, I mean, we've got like but there's still folks out there saying that, and nobody's challenging them when they say it.
Well, and that's really unfortunate, because you don't have to go to computer models. You can go to simple physical measurements. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat. For 10,000 years, we had the same amount, 280 parts per million, until the middle of the 19th century when the world began to industrialize. That 280 is now up to 380. That is a level this planet has not experienced for 420,000 years. And that's what's causing the heating. It's causing the prolonged droughts. It's causing the more intense storms, the more frequent heat waves, the more intense downpours. And this is not a question of computer models and iffy mathematics. These are measurements taken on the mountains of Hawaii of how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere, which is the primary byproduct of our burning coal and oil. So that would be my answer to the state climatologist of Oregon. Where did he get his science? Where did he get his measurements? You know?
Well, I think he's pulling it out of his ear, as they say.
Okay.
How many years has it been since we had this high level of carbon in the atmosphere?
420,000.
420,000 years.
Yeah.
Amazing. So are you prepared to say, Ross Gelbspan, author of Boiling Point and The Heat Is On, website heatisonline.org, are you prepared to say that Hurricane Katrina has, not to say that it existed, but that it had the intensity that it did and did the damage that it did in part because of the fact that we have been pumping all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by having high, you know, lousy gas mileage cars, you know, high fuel consumption cars, and the profligate use of fossil fuels over the last century?
I think there's no question about it, Tom. A warmer atmosphere does not make more frequent hurricanes, but it certainly makes them more intense. Hurricanes take their energy from the surface water temperatures. When Katrina began, it was a small Category 1 hurricane. It glanced off Florida. I think it had 70-mile-an-hour winds. The temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico, the surface temperatures are around 28 degrees Celsius, and that infused this hurricane with this huge amount of power, this heartbreaking amount of damage that would not have happened elsewhere. There was a really interesting study out, coincidentally, about 3 weeks ago from a researcher at MIT who noted that tropical storms have become 50% more intense over the last 30 years because of these warming surface waters. And there are stories that I just put on the website this morning from the science advisor to Tony Blair, from another group of experts who foresee more Katrinas, and tie the intensity of that storm directly to global warming.
Now, Ross Gelbspan, on the New York Times yesterday, and this, of course, is one of the headlines on Drudge Report today, is a story saying that this is just part of a natural cycle. Where are you familiar with the story? Do you know what I'm talking about here?
No, unfortunately, I didn't see it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. You'll need to check that out.
That's okay.
Yeah, because it's just, you know, maybe I can pull it up while we're talking. But basically, they've got a couple of scientists there who are just, you know, coming along and saying, you know, this is just part of the normal thing, you know, just what comes along. How is it possible that that for example, the New York Times can be saying this sort of thing when, you know, when you're saying what you're saying? I mean, there's a disconnect here.
Well, there are some scientists who are skeptical about this. Nevertheless, they constitute a really small minority. There are a few scientists who we've demonstrated around the take from the coal and oil industries, but I'm assuming the scientists the Times talk to are not among those. There are scientists like Bill Gray of the National Hurricane Service who are skeptical about climate change. But again, they're in a tiny minority. And what I mentioned before is that what the consensus view among more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries in this really rigorously peer-reviewed findings, they projected in 1995 that we will see more intense hurricanes from warming surface waters from earlier than that. They strengthened that in 2001 when they came out with their 2001 report. So, sure, there are a few dissenters, that's fine, but the huge, overwhelming weight in the community of legitimate climate scientists is that there is a distinct connection between more intense hurricanes and warming surface waters.
Yeah, this is really interesting. Drudge is no longer linking to it, and I can't find it now on the New York Times website. I wonder if they took it down.
All right.
Huh, interesting. Interesting, very interesting. So the Bush administration, you said, is working hand in glove with these folks. Actually, before I get to that, we've got a caller. Joe in South Carolina has a question. You mind taking a call?
Sure.
Okay, we're talking with Russ Gelbspan. We're talking about Hurricane Katrina. Joe in South Carolina, you're live with Russ Gelbspan.
Oh, what I wanted to say was that the agriculture part of it, the insurance companies are charging for this global warming stuff, and they are putting it in their markups of when they have insurance.
Yeah, tell us about the insurance. Thank you, Joe. Ross, tell us about the impact of this on insurance. I remember reading in The Heat Is On that reinsurance companies were getting very alarmed.
Absolutely, extremely so, because they're the ones who really take it on the chin from all the property losses and the property damage and so forth. Last year set a record. There were $145 billion in insurance losses last year, and as a result, companies like Swiss Reinsurance, General Accident in Britain, Munich Reinsurance, are becoming really concerned about this. They're becoming much more politically proactive about it. That's not happening in the U.S. The insurers in the U.S. are basically keeping their heads down politically, and they're trying to sort of cover their backsides by passing along the cost to consumers. And they're stopping insuring coastlines. They're no longer insuring known storm corridors and so forth. Nevertheless, the insurance industry as a whole, the property insurers and the reinsurers, are very, very concerned about this, and they are now saying that it threatens the survival of their industry.
And some of the U.S. insurers are now putting acts of God clauses in their contracts. So basically they're just saying, you know, we're not going to deal with global warming
problems. That's right, and they're simply redlining coastal areas and known storm corridors, and they're simply refusing to provide insurance to the people who live in those areas.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the wonderful world, Bush world here. Ross Gelbspan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for giving this WTO time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're doing great work. His book, The Boiling Point, his newest book. Before that, Heat Is On. The website, heatisonline.org. Ross Gelbspan, a great man doing fine work. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 and one half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Talk radio for the rest of us. John in New York, you're on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I know of a technology that can hurricane-proof a house using styrofoam forms. You sandwich the cement in between. It costs 15% more only to build the house.
Right.
I'm sure they're doing a lot of it as it is down, but if these insurance companies would put the extra 15%, they would more than likely not have to deal with that ever again. It's termite-proof, hurricane-proof. It's got a bomb shelter in the basement and everything.
Yeah, so now this will deal with what? A wind up to 130 miles an hour, 150 miles an hour?
Yeah, it goes to Category 5 tornadoes, too. They can get protected against in these houses.
Huh, interesting.
But, if you look it up, it's polysteel.com. Take a look at it. They build normal full security offices out of it. Super insulates the whole house, so you can run it on nearly nothing.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John. Right, I appreciate information. Ed in San Juan, California on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'm thinking about changing my name to just a confused, compassionate conservative.
Just a confused, compassionate conservative?
Yeah, so Ed won't call you anymore.
Okay.
I was listening to the people this morning call up some place. I made a mistake. I listened to a radio show for a minute. And people are saying we should bring out the National Guard and shoot the looters in Louisiana.
Well, there's two problems with that. One, the National Guard's in Iraq.
Yeah,
sorry to break the news to you, but in fact, they took all the generators with them, and they took the Humvees, and they took the amphibious vehicles. They're all in Iraq. And number two, shoot the looters.
Yeah, it's that's why I'm a compassionate conservative, I guess. But I just wanted to know, did we do everything we could to get as many people out as we could, like every bus in the city, every school bus? And did we take and maybe set up the National Guard? Did we rent our tents from, in the government, who's renting us all our tents for the armed forces? You know, we rent our tents from Halliburton.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't we have rented some tents for these people out of the thing? But we left them in the city to fend for themselves, and now our answer is to shoot them.
Yeah, well, see, SELA is the program to reinforce the dikes, and then there's also programs for the Corps of Engineers to do things like managing evacuations and putting all this stuff together. And as editor and publisher magazine, which is the I guess you'd call it the trade magazine of the writing business, right? It's the magazine for people in the newspaper and magazine business.
Right. Oh, yeah.
As they wrote in an article, quote, over the next 10 years, the Army Corps of Engineers, tasked with carrying out SELA, that's this thing for, you know, boosting, building up the dikes and whatnot, spent $430 million on shoring up levees and building pumping stations with $50 million in local aid. But at least $250 million in crucial projects remained, even as hurricane activity in the Atlantic Basin increased dramatically and the levees surrounding New Orleans continued to subside. Yet after 2003, the flow of federal dollars towards SELA dropped to a trickle. The Corps never tried to hide the fact that the spending pressures of the war in Iraq, coming at the same time as federal tax cuts, was the reason for the strain. At least 9 articles in the Times-Picayune, that's the newspaper in New Orleans, from 2004 and 2005, specifically cite the cost of Iraq as the reason for the lack of hurricane and flood control dollars. So I would say, Ed, in all probability, the answer to your question is, no, they were not ready for this. No, they did not have the preparation things in place. And the reason why is because all the funding that would have allowed that to be was pulled out and sent was sent to give to Halliburton in Iraq, where, by the way, we have already spent 187, I think it is, billion dollars now in Iraq, and we've got $300 billion allocated for Iraq. We're going to rebuild that country with $300 billion, but we can rebuild three states in the southeast for, what, $25 billion? It's really rather startling how much more bang for the buck we get here than when we pay Halliburton and we have to pay $150,000 a year to people to serve food to GIs in line.
And I'm just offended that people in this country say shoot other citizens.
Yeah, and shoot other citizens. Yeah, that's a tragedy as well. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, shoot the looters. Instead of, you know, hey, what about shooting the politicians who screwed up the situation so badly that the looting is happening? Well, you know, not that I'm not recommending that, of course, but geez.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet at radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, a podcast on Apple iTunes. Tom Hayden is with us. Tom Hayden, your most recent piece here about the exiting Iraq, a strategy for exiting Iraq. I think it's absolutely brilliant, Tom. Welcome to the program.
My goodness. Thank you very much.
This is. I mean, here we are in the middle of this national disaster, the Katrina,
right.
this natural national disaster, and then we've got the George Bush, you know, kind of man-made natural disaster, or disaster, let's say, over in Iraq, and we're discovering now that all the pumps and the generators and the amphibious vehicles for Louisiana are in Iraq. We've got some serious problems. There's a lot of good reasons to get out of Iraq. And not the least of which is that, you know, we're over there for a lie and we're killing people unnecessarily. You suggest that it's possible to actually exit from Iraq in a rational and straightforward fashion without it giving the terrorists what they want and without it being a Vietnam-like scenario. Is that correct?
Well, it's been a faith-based war, you know, Tom, all along. So I'm not sure what the president is doing. The most disheartening thing is the apparent failure of the constitutional talks. I say apparent because the U.S. ambassador over there brokered the deal, and the neocons have been writing pieces in the press on cue suggesting that this is a good deal, the best we can get. But it kind of guarantees a civil war scenario where the United States is backing a coalition arrangement between the Shiites and the Kurds with their militias against the Sunni triangle. And it's a setback for women. There's a lot wrong with it. But it's a formula for a civil war. And I think
the Constitution as it stands?
Yeah. You have an arrangement where the Sunnis are alienated, the Shiites are empowered, the Kurds are empowered, and what's described as the Iraqi security forces are really the militias of the Shiites and the Kurds. So this is sponsored by the U.S., brokered by the U.S., funded by the U.S. I mean, if you were looking for a way out of the war and the violence, you would insist on incorporating the Sunni demands for their share of resources and representation. But it's as if, you know, the anti-Saddam, anti-Ba'athist, anti-Sunni crusade has now been endorsed fully by the Americans, and there's no way out of this. I mean, a peace arrangement would consist of representation for the Sunnis in exchange for a lessening of the violence, I think. We're going in absolutely the opposite direction, and the media, which has been a little better in covering the state of the war and the president, has been blinded by some paradigm of democracy to think that this constitution, any constitution, is better than nothing, as if it's better than violence. But the constitution is actually a license for civil war and violence.
We're talking with Tom Hayden. TomHayden.com on the web, by the way, for everything that Tom is up to right now. Tom, it almost seems like, and this is like, you know, I should play Twilight Zone music when I say it. It almost seems like we want the violence to continue. I mean, why, if we didn't want the violence to continue, there's a couple of very clear steps that we could take. If we want the violence to continue, if we want there to be civil war, then we should be doing exactly what we're doing. Why?
Right. Well,
upside is there to the Bush administration?
I'm not very good at reading the minds of these people, and as Wolfowitz said, they only chose weapons of mass destruction because that was the most convenient argument. So there's multiple motives here, but if you look at the outcome, it's the dismembering of Iraq as a nation state. And why is that important to these neocons? It's important because, in their view, Iraq was the strongest of the Arab nations and the largest threat to Israel. It's important because the Iraqi nation-state was a barrier to any kind of economic takeover of Iraqi resources such as oil. So you do see a pattern here. After the Cold War and the end of communism, you see the weakening of nation states. Yugoslavia is one. Iraq is another. Venezuela will be next.
So
I don't know if they sit around a table saying, you know, let's get rid of Chavez and weaken the Venezuelan state so that we can get our grip on oil.
Well, they probably just wink and nod, and everybody knows what's going on. I mean, it's
well, but, I don't know. I mean, has Bush known this from the beginning? I mean, Bush was given rhetoric for the last 3 years saying that he wanted a strong Iraq with a central government, blah blah blah, and he switched on a dime here, saying this is a wonderful constitution. It's actually a setback for women. It's actually setting in motion a Shiite republic in the south, aligned with Iran. It's anything but what he promised. Those of us interested in a way out have to now think hard about what it means to get out of a civil war.
Mm-hmm. Or simply let the civil war resolve itself. I mean,
I don't know what you think. I mean, most Americans didn't sign up for choosing sides in a civil war.
Yeah. Well, my take on it is that these three regions, the southern Shia region, the central Sunni region, and the northern Kurdish region, were separate states of the Ottoman Empire prior to World War
I. That's right.
And the British glued them together because there was oil there, and they wanted there to be a strong central government to control the oil both in the north and in the south and supply oil to England and the greater British Empire. And so, you know, it was a put-together state in the first place, and it may well be that somebody with a mind like Brzezinski, for example, is, you know, the great chess game, that he may be thinking, or not he specifically, but, you know, people who are, you know, geopolitical strategists or whatever, may be thinking, you know, really what needs to happen here, and it's becoming increasingly obvious since the invasion, the successful invasion and the failed occupation, what really needs to happen here is to divide this country back up into those original three Ottoman states. It'll be easier to negotiate with smaller, weaker governments to get their oil. We can simply buy it from them.
Exactly.
It'll be easier to negotiate with them to have our military bases there. We principally want to have military bases, or we in a large way, want to have military bases in the central part of the country as well. And if the Sunnis don't have oil, then they'll be dependent upon us for financial aid, which will, you know, make them more likely to say, sure, have a base here. We can take the money from that, from rent or something. I mean, it seems like there's some upsides, but if our administration just came out tomorrow morning and said, you know, we're going to divide Iraq into three countries now that we've got it, there would be a hue and cry from one end of the world to the other. So instead, they're letting nature take its course. They're letting these three factions that are largely separated. I mean, geographically separated. There is some intermixing, particularly in Baghdad, but those three areas are pretty much discrete. They're letting them have their little war, and there is a civil war going on right now. It's been going on for months, and it seems like perhaps the resolution of it will be, we'll call it a federal republic, but really it's going to be three states, three autonomous regions that are going to be, for all practical purposes, three separate nations.
Well, I'm not, as an Irish-American, I'm not a fan of the British role anywhere, but this is the British divide and conquer strategy.
Yeah, it's what they did with Ireland.
Yes, and by the way, the British still have troops in Northern Ireland.
That's right.
But the little problem here for this kind of mastermind scenario is they've got a war on their hands where American troops are being attacked 65 times a day on average, and the insurgency is increasing. So the anti-war movement has to hopefully capitalize on the August protests of Cindy Sheehan and the forthcoming exit strategy hearings in Washington on the 15th of September, the 24th to 26th demonstrations in Washington. And keep in mind, that we're now facing a completely different situation. We are now opposing a civil war,
How can you oppose a civil war in somebody else's country?
Well, I don't think Americans feel supportive towards intervening in civil wars and getting sunk there. The British have done that for years. It's not in the American style. So I actually think it hurts Bush to have a civil war on his hands. But more on this, if you go to the Progressive Democrats' website, I think it's pdamerica.org.
That's right.
There's a petition to get out of Iraq, and I'd urge people to read it and hopefully sign it. We want to present it to members of Congress who are in their usual quandary. I can't believe that both parties stand for war at a time when the majority of the American people are in favor of getting out of Iraq sooner rather than later. But we have to we have to somehow pressure and convince this Congress that it can't just sit passively and let Bush's strategy play out. What do you think?
Well, do you think, Tom Hayden, that it is necessary for an anti-war movement to put forward a vision of how peace should happen in order for that to happen? I mean, isn't it really enough to say, you know, this really wasn't our war. We got lied into this war. You know, however it shakes out, it's not America's war. And yes, there is some reality to the fact that, you know, we broke it, but that doesn't necessarily mean we own it. It means that we certainly have some obligation to do reparations, like the Germans did war reparations after World War II. We've caused considerable harm and a lot of death, and we have to own up to that and deal with that in some way. But continuing to kill people is not the way to do that. And getting stuck in the middle of the Civil War is not the way to do that. And, you know, perhaps, I mean, we can all hypothesize what should be done. I mean, you know, in my mind, the logical thing to do would be, you know, something like some variation on what was done in Yugoslavia. You know, bring in the United Nations or bring in NATO and let's, you know, get together a, you know, some sort of a negotiating body and literally negotiate the split up of Iraq into three autonomous regions and each absolutely independent and let them go whatever way they want to go. But you know, let's have peace, and, you know, right away, and let's get America out of there.
Well, many in the anti-war movement simply think we should stand with the position of out now, and not we don't have any right to meddle in these arrangements. In
yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that.
I don't think that's a bad stance at all. There's one thing though that I think is two things to bear in mind. One is that the Americans in the middle, including our elected leaders, seem very, very hesitant just to get out now. They don't understand it. They need to have a scenario. The second is that there's an Iraqi peace movement that is trying to broker talks with the insurgents and get the United States off of its aggressive patrols, back into defensive positions, ultimately withdraw. A majority of Iraqis in a January poll said they were for the near-term withdrawal of the U.S. 82 members of the Iraqi National Assembly, that's the one that we created, have called in June for the end of the occupation. The so-called militant Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, his forces collected 1 million signatures last month for U.S. withdrawal.
Not to mention the hundreds of thousands of people he can pull into the streets
yes.
on an afternoon's notice.
And a former member of the American-sponsored regime after the invasion, Mr. Samaré, has left the government and has set up a political organization to broker peace talks. So it seems to me if you want to save lives, you do have to dive into this mess and demand that the U.S. Acknowledge that it was a mistake, decide to get out, appoint a negotiator, a peace envoy, start working immediately to disengage and work with the Iraqis who are working for an alternative to violence, some kind of political settlement that will include the Sunnis and not feed the rebellion. So, I mean, we have a lot to offer, the withdrawal and, as you say, the continuation of some kind of reconstruction aid or Marshall Plan through the UN, not through the U.S. And it seems to me most of the insurgents are nationalists of different stripes, and they're fighting to the death for sovereignty. And if the United States recognizes that, even the former CIA director John Deutsch has called for withdrawal.
Yeah, but the predicating.
So where are the Democrats? Where are the Republicans? What?
Yeah.
It makes you think that there's an element here in everybody's thinking in our leadership in this country that we have a right to have an outpost over there in the Middle East, and that we are going to stay. And that
I think it may well be, but I think that there's also the George Romney fear. You know, the old governor of Michigan, who at one time had a shot at becoming the Republican presidential candidate,
right,
until he came back from Vietnam and said he'd been brainwashed. I don't think that any Democrats want to say we were wrong, and certainly the Republicans don't want to say we're wrong. And the thing that predicated everything you just said is we have to admit that it was a mistake. So I just
well, no, there's a way I could write the speech for the hawk if I could find a hawk who wanted to become a dove.
Well, I hope you can do that, Tom Hayden. Get it out there in print. We've got to wrap up this segment. I appreciate your being with us. TomHayden.com for more information, and PDDemocrats.org as well for the Progressive Democrats of America.
PDA America.
PDA America. Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
All right.
PD
Bye-bye.
America. Yeah. Yeah. Tom Hayden with us. It is 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, a lot of folks in Louisiana looking for some shelter right now. And that shelter could have been there if the Bush administration had not been slashing funding ever since 2002. For reinforcing and strengthening the levees and dikes around New Orleans, and for boosting the ability of the area to respond to exactly this kind of an emergency. In 2003, the Times-Picayune writing about, we need to be prepared to deal with a Category 5 hurricane. Bush administration, no, it's more important to have tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Sorry. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Marshall in Virginia on the line. Hey, Marshall, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I was calling about Section 215 of the Patriot Act.
Yes, sir. That's the part that allows the government to go to libraries and bookstores and say who's buying your books, who's reading them.
Indeed. And that's why I was wondering more about the formality of it. You know, is it more that they have red flags that go up if somebody checks out a certain book, or do they have to have, you know, are they going to look for something in particular?
No, they go in, my understanding, I may be wrong on this, but my understanding is that they can go in and ask for information on either who checked out, we'd like the names of all the people who checked out this particular book, or they can say, we understand that Joe Blow has a library card with you, we'd like to know all the books that Joe Blow checked out. They can do either way.
Okay, because I, about 3 weeks ago, checked out this book called Unequal Protection.
Yeah, you're in deep trouble, Marshall.
And that's what I was afraid of.
You know, that writer, he's one of those subversives. It's
exactly. And one more thing kind of relating to this book. I have a job interview tomorrow with UPS.
Uh-huh.
And my mom has said UPS is employee-owned. Is that any different than all the rest of these filthy corporations?
Well, you know, to some extent, it's a whole lot better. I don't know what percentage of UPS's stock is actually held by its employees, and I don't know how it's held, and I don't know how the employees, what ability the employees have to vote on it. So I can't speak specifically to UPS. But there are a lot of companies out there where their employees have significant chunks of stock ownership. Hertz is another one. Avis. And it works out as a generally, broadly, a fairly good thing. On the other hand, there are companies that say that they are employee-owned, and what they really mean, like Enron, for example, what they really mean is that they gave each one of their employees a few shares of stock, or they encouraged their employees to invest in their stock in their 401k or something. You know, so sometimes it's a scam. But, UPS, it's a union shop. I think it's a fairly decent company. I can't speak poorly of them, but... You know, as I said, I've not ever carefully looked into them. But check it out, Marshall. A job's a job right now. Good luck, too. And thanks for reading my book on equal protection. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Speaking from behind a good old working-class stainless steel microphone. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 and a half, 7 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, all across the United States. Welcome to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Alec Dubrow is with us. Alec is what's your title there, Alec?
King of all media.
Okay, Alec is the king of all media at the International Labor Communications Association. Their website, ilcaonline.org. ilcaonline.org. And Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom, and I'm bringing my annual Labor Day message to you. I guess it's my first annual Labor Day message, but nevertheless, it's a Labor Day message.
Yeah, Labor Day coming up here soon. So what is your Labor Day message, Alec?
Keep hope alive.
There you go. That's a good one. I applaud that. Yes.
Yes, indeed. I want to say that, yes, labor's in trouble, but, you know, labor's been in trouble before, and that it has its ups and downs over the years. And what's interesting is that, well, a couple of things. One is that we have been at this level of unionization before, which is fairly low. Although, as we pointed out in past shows, in absolute numbers, it really hasn't changed a great deal since the end of the war. It's just the vast growth of the workforce has meant that the percentages have dropped.
When was the last time we were at this percentage? It must have been
In the early part of the 20th century, actually.
Yeah. Maybe the early 1920s?
Private sector was higher, but there wasn't any public sector organizing, so that overall it was we're doing a little better than it had been in the early part of the 20th century. But, you know, one of the... We're under assault from a lot of areas, but there are other factors than the mere hostility of management to account for this. And by the way, I do want to point out that management is extremely hostile and extremely adept, but let's remember that until the middle of the 20th century, management used to routinely shoot strikers, and you don't get much more hostile than that.
Yeah, there has always been this dynamic tension. I mean, there's never been a time when there wasn't conflict between management and workers. There's evidence that the people who built the pyramids might have been organized into guilds.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did hear some of that on a show on Egypt, and that there were work stoppages.
Yeah.
Toward the end of the reign of Ramesses, that he had run out of money, and the workers said, "Well, that's just too bad.
Yeah,
you know, we're not going to do it."
Right. And so what he ended up doing was he marched them all up into the desert, killed them all, and buried them in the sand.
I guess that taught them, didn't it?
He's the ultimate employer, right? So anyway, there are some unions who are actually growing right now.
There are, and it's interesting. I spent this morning talking to representatives from, there's four or five of them that have grown over the past few years. Two teachers unions, the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, SEIU, which is probably the best known for its growth, and the Laborers International Union, and they've all had growth. And while they all say that one of the major reasons is that they grew because they decided to grow, and besides deciding, they put the resources into organizing. Now, that makes sense. You know, if you want to achieve a goal, you have to come up with what it takes to get it.
Yeah, in a business, it's called having a marketing budget.
That's exactly it. And in other cases, in the case of other unions, there are certainly things working against them, that are declining industries. Although, as it's very interesting, the UAW, of which I'm a member through the Writers Union, has watched its membership decline. But the fact is that automobile manufacturing in the United States now is about one quarter non-union, whereas at one point it was 100% union, not because the U.S. manufacturers have broken any unions, but because of the foreign manufacturers coming in. There's now like 60,000 people work at foreign-owned plants, and those are not unionized yet. So In some cases, it is in truth, like the steel industry. The industry has simply collapsed in terms of domestic employment. But in other cases, it's not quite that. And it does mean that unions have to put in the resources. One of the most interesting things I found out is about the laborers, which is a construction union.
This is the name of a union, the laborers union?
The laborers union. Mm-hmm. And they grew up as sort of the bottom of the construction pile initially.
Right.
That is, it was, you know, the skilled trades were the carpenters and the iron workers.
Right.
And the,
are the laborers part of the AFL-CIO?
They are they're hanging in right now.
Okay.
They were part of the group that was deciding to split off, but they have not yet made the move.
Okay.
But in any case, it's very interesting that they are a decentralized union and they do their organizing out of eight different regions. And their representative told me that the responsibility for this organizing lies with the members themselves in those regions. And what they've decided to do is institute a checkoff for organizing, which amounts to anywhere between 5 cents and 25 cents an hour that the workers put in. You know, and based on a vote that they take. And that funds millions and millions of dollars worth of organizing. That they understand that the old saying that every unorganized worker is a threat to every organized worker because they're going to work for less and they're going to work under worse conditions and that it undercuts their pay. Well, they decided to take some action and it's apparently paying off. Fascinating stuff.
So we've got SEIU and the laborers, the American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association. These are unions that are actually experiencing growth right now.
That's true. They are experiencing.
And they all seem to be doing something in common.
What they have in common is a commitment to organizing, but they all have slightly different takes on it. And there is no one answer that changes these trends or that, you know, that comes up with different tactics and different strategies. But the fact is a certain amount of commitment makes a great deal of difference.
Yeah. So what are the lessons, you know, what's the take-home message in all this, Alec?
Well, like I say, that the responsibility ultimately lies not with the leadership but with the membership themselves. That is, if they are willing to take the responsibility, there's only two things you can contribute to any campaign ever anywhere, and that's either time or money. You know, either they can do the organizing themselves or they can tax themselves to put the money in and see that their union hires the people or assigns the people to do the work. But it really has to come out of the rank and file. If they are caught in a circle of despair and say, you know, oh, it's anti-union, there's so many things ranged against us, there's nothing we can do, then it tends to work out that way. You know, I'm not saying that every campaign, even if you fund it, is going to work out in favor of labor. That's not true, and it would be, you know, delusional to think so. But you simply don't have a chance unless you take this. And that's why I said it half jokingly, but the truth is keep hope alive. You know, labor has a lot of things. It means a lot of things to a lot of people, but in addition to raising wages, labor has a heart and it has an ideology, even if it won't speak it every time. But if you keep those alive and you keep and if the people accept it, if they want it, they will find a way to do this stuff.
Excuse me, Alex.
Got
distracted there. Yes, absolutely. And so what can people who are not in organized labor, by the way, somebody called us a little earlier, didn't hang out over the break, but had some information on UPS and employee ownership. I'm curious about that. We had somebody call in with a question about that. Some companies claim to be employee owned. And I know UPS is a unionized company. It's a union shop.
Yes.
Apparently they claim to be employee owned. What does that mean?
I don't know a great deal about it. All I know is that when United moved to be employee owned,
United Airlines?
United Airlines. You know, the fact is, it's whether the ownership, that is the financial ownership, is spread among the employees, or if it were publicly traded and the general public owns it, the fact is it's still run by management. And in some employee-owned companies are just as badly managed and just as mean as any other company. It really has to do with stock, and it doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with the posture or the way the company deals.
So the employees can have ownership in the company and still have no say in the company?
Essentially, yes. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, they may have a say, but on a day-to-day basis, it may not be any friendlier. I don't know, I don't know the particulars of UPS, but it'd certainly be worth looking into, and I'd be glad to do that for future shows.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at that.
Or just in general, I think that would be an interesting topic for a program. Is
right.
You know, to what extent is employee ownership of companies a rubric or a front for trying to diminish the power of employees and encourage them? I mean, I can just see the management seminar right now, right, where the CEO is getting all the senior executives together and they're saying, you know, we're going to give a little bit of stock to all the people working here so that they'll feel more committed, so they'll work harder, and we'll make more money. We're not going to give them any say in anything, but they're going to work harder, trust me. And or, on the other hand, you know, the situation where you actually have employees who actually own the company, you know, where it's a cooperative for all practical purposes.
Yeah, there are cooperatively owned companies, and they're unwieldy. They're difficult in a capitalist society to run a cooperatively owned company. And
but there's a lot of them that are relatively small-sized companies that are very successful. I know there were quite a few of them in Vermont when I lived there. I haven't had an opportunity to find out, you know, what the labor terrain is like here in Oregon, but I know that's happening out there.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sunkist is cooperatively owned. I mean, it's a cooperative of farmers,
yeah.
But it's not quite the same thing.
That's a marketing organization,
yeah.
Though. That's a little different.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. Alec Dubrow, ILCA Online, the International Labor
Communications
Association. And
that's right.
You are the king of all media.
But the
media coordinator.
When you call, ask for the media coordinator.
Okay. There you go. Alec, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Happy Labor Day.
Thank you. Happy Labor Day to you, too. I do appreciate it. Great to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Peter Werby, I don't usually talk about what's going on my individual affiliates because there's a lot of people who aren't in that city and don't know what I'm talking about. But this is Peter Werby is an old and dear friend of mine. He and Peter B. Collins and I were all on IE America Radio together back when it was the first liberal talk radio network many years ago. And today Peter is going to be filling in for Peter B. Collins on KRXA in Monterey, California, one of the stations that carries this program. And so if you're listening on KRXA, I just want to recommend that you listen in to Peter Werby and be sure and give him a call and you know, say hi to him, give him a hard time, ask him questions, whatever. But interact with him. He's a great guy, and he does a fine show. You'll enjoy it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Come together right now over me.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into the live chat room, just click live chat. Or if you want to participate in our blog. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Sorry to take you away from something.
I know. Two phone calls came in at the same time, and I'm going to ask the other caller if I can call them right back, and which I will do.
Okay.
And here I am.
Okay, great. Thank you. What's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, people are just trying to sift through what, if anything, could have been done ahead of time in New Orleans to minimize the destruction of the city, who might be to blame for all of that, and also the question being asked in Washington is, do we want to rebuild New Orleans? I think a question that's sort of stunning everybody, but people are asking it, do they want to pay for this in light of the fact that this could happen again? And the answers are kind of coming up no, although ultimately I think we will opt to rebuild it, but there is a strong sense that, you know, we rebuild in Florida every year, and each time we rebuild, we get another hurricane. So that's part of it. But the main thing that people are talking about in Washington is gas prices and the gouging that seems to be going on.
Wow. Sounds like your other phone is going off there.
It's one of those days.
It's a busy day. So George W. has a lot on his plate here. He's got the oil price going through the roof. He's releasing oil from the Strategic Reserve. That is going to have an effect on the price of oil by the barrel, but in all probability it'll have no effect whatsoever on the price of gasoline.
Right.
A lot of pundits are suggesting that there's going to be as much as a 60-cent increase in the price of gas over the next few weeks.
That seems very likely. Certainly, I don't know about your area, but we've already seen at least a 20 cent, in some cases 30 or 40 cent increase overnight.
Wow! No, I haven't looked because I drive a Toyota Prius, so I only fill it up once a month.
No, well, you see, I drive a little Hyundai, and so
same thing.
I don't fill it up that often either, and yeah. I'm very glad that I do.
Yeah, it's. I'll tell you, it's funny. I was having this conversation with one of my kids the other day. I said, now would be a good time if you want to make an investment to go out and buy a whole bunch of high mileage cars, you know, with the idea that it's 6 months from now, you can probably sell them for more than they cost because there's just going to be so much demand for these things. It's growing right now. I mean, there's a year waiting list to get a Toyota Prius in some areas.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Crazy.
It's just the auto companies totally failed on this. Now, the Bush administration has been cutting, now since 2003, this according to this article in Editor and Publisher, which compiled the columns in the Times-Picayune, the New Orleans newspaper, for 3 years now, 2.5 years anyway, the Bush administration has been cutting money to the Corps of Engineers program that would reinforce the dikes around, or the whatever they call those levees, I guess they call them down there.
Yeah.
Reinforce the levees around New Orleans, and that, and the New Orleans National Guard, most of their generators and their amphibious equipment is now in Iraq. Are these simple realities being brought out much, or is the administration really going to be able to do a good job of spin control and keep the American people from even knowing about these things?
Well, I think the administration could do some spin control today. They've got wonderful opportunities for the president to look presidential in a meeting he's going to be chairing later this afternoon when he returns to D.C. of emergency management heads and things like that. However, he's back now, and there will be a gaggle. There will be a briefing, and they will be televised on C-SPAN, and they will come under questioning for this. Yes, that finally there will be questioning that the American public can hear. Even though there were press briefings while he was in Texas, it didn't receive very much coverage, and I think it will now. And this story, you know, of the lack of funding that's been going on for the last couple of years has really received very, very little coverage on the all news channels, mostly because they're covering the disaster. But I would predict that story is going to start to peak in the next day or so, too, as questions are asked.
Yeah, I mean, for all practical purposes, I've seen no coverage of it in the mainstream media at all.
You know?
And yeah, because so much of the damage that happened apparently could have been prevented had the Bush administration not had to cut money away from these programs in order to have their tax cuts for the multimillionaires and billionaires. And we could have had much more rapid response to this with the National Guard had they not had to drag them all off to Iraq. Victoria Jones, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Don't worry about a thing. Every little bit gonna be all right.
Yeah, it'll all work out, my friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 33 and a half minutes past the hour. Things do tend to work out. You know, if you decide right up front, I'm going to make lemonade out of whatever lemons are given to me, generally, you can. And, you know, what's the old saying? You know, life is tough and then you die. I mean, you know, eventually it reaches an end point. But even then, that might be a door into something just absolutely extraordinary. So I'm absolutely convinced that we must look at the upside of things. And here's an upside. The budget reconciliation. Actually, this is a little... It's going to take more than just a minute to tell you about this. Let me take a couple calls here first, and then we'll get to that. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Our phone number, 866-889-8894. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida on the line. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to let people know we're talking about the creation of hurricanes, and they are made as a function of warm Gulf water, and that's why we don't have hurricanes during the winter.
Right.
Every day on the weather here, whether it's on the television, they
and tell you. And let's just add, by the way, for our listeners who don't know about this and how this works, that the hurricanes come about. They start out with a thunderstorm someplace out over the Atlantic, and if that storm gets if the air that is below that storm gets over water that is warmer than the air is. Then that starts the process that forms the hurricane. And the warmer that water is relative to the air above it, the greater the what's called the gradient or the differential, the greater that temperature difference, then the more violent that hurricane will become.
Now, right. Now, when we get the weather report, they tell you what the water in the Gulf is. I'm about, 5 kilometers from the water. It's been 94 degrees.
Yeah.
The air temperature is 90. Now, you know, you can't ignore the reality. You know, this is global warming personified. And it reminds me of during the late 60s and the 70s when there were still holdouts who said smoking doesn't cause cancer. We heard that. Somebody always found some doctor somewhere that said, well, it's really the sulfur when you strike a match and then you light the cigarette, that's really what causes the cancer, or
yeah.
Something else.
I remember when I was a kid, I remember Ronald Reagan dressed up like a doctor on TV saying, if
yeah.
you have a sore throat, smoke Chesterfields.
Right, right. So, you know, the same people that say there is no such thing as global warming and there is no such thing, you know, it's not creating these hurricanes, are the same group of folks, okay, who said cancer doesn't cause smoking and it's all a bunch of crackpots that are saying it. But 94 degrees. Now, when you take a bath, it's probably about, 96?
No, it would have to be warmer than your body temperature
okay,
for you to feel like warm. 105, 110, something like that.
Well, about 110. But, you know, 94-degree beach water temperature is pretty darn warm.
Right.
Not many people go to the beach encountering water that's 94 degrees.
Yeah.
That's pretty extraordinary. But I just
now, how long have you lived down there, Phil?
3 years.
Over the last 3 years, has it gotten to 94 before? I mean, is this...
No, not this warm.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, 94 is quite... You just don't expect that kind of warmth when you go into the water at the beach.
So we still have another roughly 2 months to go in hurricane season, don't we?
At least.
So
at least.
Odds are there's more coming.
And this has been one of the warmest summers. Every day it's 92 to 93 degrees with a... You know, and it cools down to 80 at night.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been a record hot summer, and of course this started in April,
mm-hmm.
and we can expect it for another 8 weeks of the same kind of weather.
Yeah.
But I just want to tail up on what the interview related to the unions was. I he was saying that there's been a growth in teachers' unions. I'm a former teacher, and I read that the postings from different states. They have a website that has teachers can post from different states. Teachers are real unhappy with the union, I got to tell you. Schwarzenegger, there was a constitutional amendment that said there wasn't going to be the people voted for that said that the class sizes couldn't get any greater than 20 students for each teacher in primary grades. So that's kinder through third. And now they're up to 35. And what has the union done? Nothing. There have been layoffs. Was the union done? Nothing. Teachers have taken pay cuts for Santa Ana, which is one of the big school districts. Those guys took a big pay cut. Was the union done? Nothing. And there's a lot of complaining on these boards about how do we decertify this union? They're not doing anything for the money that they're taking from me.
Hmm.
And there's concern that...
Don't you think that the unions that are not doing this, and I'm not inside this, so this is just largely a guess on my part, but it's based on what I'm seeing with other unions elsewhere, that they feel that their very survival is threatened, that if they stick their head up and make enough noise and cause enough disruption, that people will put a ballot initiative on outlawing unions in the schools, for example, or that somehow they'll figure out a way to bust the union, and then there'll be no union.
Well, it's a de facto busting of the union right now.
Well, it's, yeah,
when you cut people's wages, lay them off, and increase class size 25%,
sure.
What's the difference?
Yeah, and they've been doing this for 25 years. I mean, this is
now,
something
this
that
is
Reagan began.
Okay, yeah, but Schwarzenegger has been doing this more than anything. Yeah. Under, you know, in the last governor, they had the 20-1. No, actually, it was under a Republican governor, and I can't remember the guy's name anymore. Mm-hmm. But anyway, because I was teaching
Pete,
there. Huh?
Pete
Wilson.
Pete Wilson,
that's,
yeah.
That's when the 20-1 initiative went on the ballot, and that's what people voted for. They amended the Constitution. He said, screw the Constitution, we're going to increase class size in order that I don't have to increase taxes on the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's pretty sad when BART, which is Bay Area Rapid Transit in San Francisco, where BART drivers are making more than teachers.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
But why? I'll tell you, because they got a strong union, and if they don't get their money, they don't come to work, and commuters don't get
right. And the answer, isn't to bash the BART union and the BART drivers. The answer is to build up and strengthen the teachers' union. And
right, I'm not bashing. Yeah. I'm saying the reason they are making a lot more than teachers is they got a strong union that says if you don't pay us what we need to live on, then we're not coming to work.
Right.
And they did that, maybe about a year ago, and people and the trains didn't run, and the city found some money. You know,
yeah, no, I got it, Phil, and I appreciate your call and making the point. It's a good point, an important one. Armin in Sarasota, Florida. Boy, it's Florida Day. Hey, Armin, what's up?
I'd like to comment quickly about teachers' unions.
Sure.
And then I'd like to go on. This may not be popular with them, what I'm going to say, but I got to say this. How many times have you seen teachers' union protest and picket against factories leaving this country, laying off the people that originally created the tax base for everybody to exploit?
I don't think that they perceive that as their job. In fact, I think that if the teachers' unions were out picketing against, for example, GM jobs going off to Asia, you'd have to wonder, you know, shouldn't those people be teaching?
What's more important? If all the jobs and all the manufacturing base is out of this country, you tell
those,
me.
Those are things that all of us as Americans should be doing, Armin. We should all be speaking up against the exporting of our jobs. We should all be speaking up against the insane trade policies and economic policies of this administration. But to say one particular union failing to speak out about issues that really are relevant to another union is wrong is, I'm sorry, I part company on that.
Tom, it's not irrelevant because...
I'm not saying it's irrelevant. No. I'm saying that it would be... It's not their job. Their job is to defend and protect and represent, really, the interests of the teachers, not the interests of the people who are working at GM, for example.
If you don't think it's the interest of the teachers that we have a tax base in this country with value-added manufacturing.
I do. I agree with you, Armin. But that is going to be, number one, it's going to be lost on most people. Number two, picketing is part of the threat of a strike. The only power that a union has, power to withhold labor. And if the teachers said, okay, we're going to go out and we're going to threaten to withhold our teaching labor over GM jobs, they'd be shooting themselves in the foot.
No, they wouldn't.
Well, okay, we're going to agree to disagree.
I disagree.
What's the other point you wanted to make, Herman?
The other point is, if I'm correct, was it a German scientist that said a long time ago, I can't remember specifically which one it was, that nothing ever infinitely changes or evaporates, it just changes matter. And my point is, as far as global warming, doesn't all the heat on our planet, it doesn't just go away in the scheme of things, it just basically it's absorbed. So all the hydrocarbons that we keep adding are building a progressing environmental influence on our planet, because all this heat, like when the sun goes down at night, we feel cooler, we have air conditioning, we have our means of our progression, as a culture, but the fact remains the waters and the earth and all these, this heat that we're putting in hydrocarbons into our environment on this earth, it's never really going away. It's just progressing and building up because it's absorbing in one form or another molecularly.
Yeah, to some extent, Armin, you're mixing up, and thank you for the call and for pointing that out. You're mixing up the heat generating capacity of hydrocarbons and the heat holding capacity of carbon dioxide. Here's how it works. When you burn fuel oil, for example, to heat your house, or you burn gasoline in your car, you burn jet fuel to propel an airplane, it does generate heat. And that does add to the heat load of the planet. But insignificantly, the amount of heat that comes from the sun is probably 99.9999, half a dozen nines after that, of all of the heat that strikes the Earth. There is some heat that comes from the core of the Earth as well. It comes up through volcanoes and whatnot, some heat that's being held by the Earth. But the vast majority of the heat that hits the planet's surface or that the atmosphere has to deal with is heat from the sun. The problem with hydrocarbons isn't that we're generating heat by burning them, or that our air conditioning is throwing heat back out into the night sky, or that the power plants that provide us with electricity are generating heat and producing the electricity. That heat is not the problem. The problem is that the carbon dioxide that is released when we burn carbon, and burning is combining oxygen with carbon, right? It's oxidized. It's rusting carbon. It's oxidizing carbon. So when you combine, you take a carbon molecule and you break it apart, a complex carbon molecule like a hydrocarbon, you break it apart and you bond oxygen to it. The waste that's produced is carbon dioxide, one atom of carbon, two atoms of oxygen. And carbon dioxide, when it gets into the atmosphere, acts like the glass on a greenhouse. The glass on a greenhouse lets the sun and the heat into the greenhouse but doesn't let it escape. And so as the carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, all that enormous amount of heat from the sun that's striking the Earth, and that normally much of it radiates back out into outer space, particularly at night when half the Earth is in the shade, that radiated cooling doesn't happen as efficiently. And much more of that heat is trapped on the surface of the Earth from that day's sunlight. And that's how global warming works. That's what the process. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi. Well, I just heard that they're opening up the drills in Wyoming, the oil wells, because it's now feasible for them to sell.
Right.
These wells are the older wells.
Yeah.
Right. When it was $5-$10 a barrel.
Yep.
So they're reaping a harvest. Why isn't the president or his administration, because that's Cheney State, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Why isn't he opening the Office of Price Administration and say, you're not going to guide these people? And he should have a study on right now, well, it should have been done a long time ago, to find out why $11 billion a quarter for the last two quarters was being made as profits by the oil company without breaking down how much they paid for the oil. This oil, or the gasoline at the pumps, could be dropped easily, 50 cents a gallon, if he would do this. But no, Condoleezza Rice and Cheney are laughing all the way to the bank because I believe...
So is the Bush family. So is the Bush family. They all are. I mean, all of the oil bunnies.
I believe that every gallon of gas that went up one penny apiece a good while back said that they would make $1 billion a day profit.
Yeah,
now, if this isn't gadget, if this isn't exploit 9/11, which he put some kind of resolution in that you weren't allowed to use 9/11 to exploit profit.
No, I don't know that there's any law like that. If there was, he couldn't have run for president.
Not a law, but, it was some type of resolution. He said no one's going to profit from 9/11.
Yeah.
That's all this administration did.
Yeah,
they're ruining America.
You're absolutely right, Jim, and I thank you for calling and pointing it out.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Well said. John in Wayland, Michigan on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
I just had a question on the hole in the ozone layer. We don't hear anything about that anymore.
It's still there.
I imagine it is. I wonder if it's been growing or what's going on. Nobody tells us anymore.
Well, it has been growing, actually. There are seasonal variations on it, of course, but the last that I read, which was about a year ago in one of the science magazines, is that a hole in the ozone layer is opening up in the northern hemisphere as well as the southern, and it's got scientists really flipped out. The on the other hand, there is the good news is that the chlorofluorocarbons, these chlorine-containing molecules that make their way up into the upper atmosphere and break down ozone and rip apart and create the hole in the ozone, that the chlorofluorocarbon load in the atmosphere is decreasing since we've outlawed the manufacture of a lot of these things.
Thank goodness for that.
So, you know, we're moving in the right direction, but there's going to be, you know, it's going to be a 50 or 100-year downhill slide to get back to normal.
Okay. One quick note just to let you know. I heard this morning that gas in Kalamazoo, Michigan was running for $3.48 a gallon.
Holy cow, $3.48. That's amazing. It wouldn't surprise me to see $4 a gallon gas, you know, within the next month. It wouldn't surprise me at all. There's such a profit opportunity here. John, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Such a profit opportunity. And, you know, it's profit opportunities, you go for it. This is, at the same time, we have poverty rising in the United States. 1.1 million people added to the rolls of the nation's officially poor. And you got to be pretty poor to be officially poor. And the Bush administration response, we need to cut the tax on Paris Hilton. End the inheritance tax. Yes, indeed, cut taxes for Paris Hilton. Oh, my. What have we done by electing all these Republicans and these conservative Democrats to office? It's time. It is time to take back America. It's time to wake up to what's going on and say, you know, we the people would really like to have somebody attend to us rather than just the multinationals for a change. 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, the nation's overall poverty rate rose 12.7% to 12.7% of the population last year. The fourth consecutive annual increase. Bushonomics, more poverty. It's very simple. In 2004, we had 37 million people living in poverty. That's up 1.1 million from 2003. Up from 31.1 million in the year 2000. Now it's 37 million. Could it have something to do with Bushonomics? Somehow I think so. I just... You know, sort of seems to make sense, you know. It's Bushonomics, yes.
1 billion pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the...
Refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yeah. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of...
Manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this,
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the piggies in their starched white shirts?
Ah, the piggies in their starched white shirts, yes.
Piggies stirring up the dirt, always have clean shirts to play.
Yes, the average CEO today makes 430 times what the average worker makes in the United States. In 2003, the average CEO made 301 times what the average worker makes in the United States. And in 1990, the average CEO in the United States made 109 times what the average worker makes. The piggies are out in force. I'll tell you, it's a piggy alert of epic proportions. At the same time, that 45.8 million Americans lack health insurance, up from 39.8 million in 2002. And to top that off, there's an article about this in today's Wall Street Journal. And in this Wall Street Journal article, they quote this guy as saying, you know, of course, the Wall Street Journal, they've got to quote a conservative, right? Quote this guy as saying, I'm paraphrasing here. The reason why is because people are choosing not to have insurance. That's why we have so many uninsured people in the United States, because they're choosing not to have insurance. Yes, people would really just rather not have health insurance. Makes sense to me. Well, Makes sense to George W. anyway. You're in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy, my friends. Take no imitations. The Tom Hartman radio program. Where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Hello, folks. This is Scott Forster. I want to talk to you folks today. I'm filling in for Tom Hartman. I appreciate it. And we'll go ahead and see how this thing goes. First guest today is June Zeitlin. And June Zeitlin is the Women's Development and Environmental Organization Director. June, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today. John Bolton at the United Nations, I would term it a war on women. He's starting off on a good foot. could you explain Bolton's recent actions and its threat to international women's issues?
Well, first of all, it's not just Bolton. It's Bolton Bush, the access of bullies. You know, Bush started his war on women globally his first day in office when he reinstated the gag rule on international family planning treaty commitments. So, I mean, what we're seeing is just a continuation that we've seen over the last several years. And this last-minute strategy by Bolton is exactly what the Bush administration has been doing at the UN to disrupt multilateral negotiations. In March, at the 10-year review of the Beijing Platform for Action, just on the eve of when the delegates gathered after they thought they had successfully negotiated a one-page declaration reaffirming the Beijing Platform for Action and its implementation, the United States walked into the session and announced that they couldn't support the declaration, and then we had to spend a week diverting attention from implementation, which is what people came to talk about, to fighting with the U.S. to simply reaffirm the commitment that had been made 10 years earlier. And as you know, in the end, they had to back down because all the countries held firm, but, you know, they managed to disrupt the process and distract attention from the issue of resources and commitment to actually implement the words that governments had signed on to. So here what we're seeing is, again, after a process that has been going on for over a year, which the U.S. has been a part of, they've come in at the last minute and said that the document is unacceptable, even though it represents a very delicate balancing between different interests to strengthen human rights, peace, and security, and development. And certainly the most recent document is much stronger on guaranteeing women's rights than the original version. Each version of the document has gotten much stronger, and now women's rights and gender equality is really integral to all the sections, development, peace, and human rights, as well as even parts of UN reform. So we're very concerned about what this is going to do for issues of concern to women worldwide, but really for all the people around the world, especially the poor who are counting on the United Nations to implement these development commitments.
Now, Ms. Zeitlin, we have a summit coming up. Could you briefly explain the summit and then link the timing of Bolton's aggressive actions to apparently insert himself and the United States into this process?
Yeah, these are directly related. The summit is it's happening September 14th to 16th. It's now called the World Summit, and it's being convened by the Secretary General of the United Nations and inviting heads of state. And we've heard that about 170, almost all the countries of the world are sending their head of state. And the idea of the summit was to consider a package of reform proposals that relate to development, human rights, and peace and security for a revitalized United Nations and multilateralism for the 21st century. This was supposed to be the crowning moment when this institution, which was created after World War II, was really updated to deal with the threats that we face on economic, political, security terms for the next century. And a lot of effort has gone into looking at how the UN functions, what kinds of new bodies are needed, like a peace-building commission, a new Human Rights Council, an expanded Security Council to reflect the changes in countries over the last 50 years. These are very serious and important issues for everybody worldwide, and particularly for women. And the action by Bolton last week was a severe blow because, like I said, for over a year there have been discussions, there have been reports, there have been different iterations of documents. This isn't going on in closed door. The United States was well aware of these proposals. They actually commented on them all along and made their views known. So to come forward at this late date and essentially ask that the whole document be thrown out, one has to question their motives. Is it really to improve the document, or is it to derail the entire summit?
Well, what do you think?
Well, I'm not a betting person, but I am very skeptical of their interest in really improving the document.
What would be
The kinds of objections they're making go to the heart of multilateralism. I mean, they're really questioning the collective role of the United Nations. They're questioning providing adequate resources. They're questioning the authority of multilateralism and questioning the role of the UN and the public sector in development and seeking a far larger role for the private sector than we've ever seen before.
Ms. Seitland is director of the Women's Development and Development Organization. Thank you very much. And, well, it sounds like you answered the question. John Bolton is doing what I perceive and many others have his mission. His mission is to disrupt the United Nations. Sounds like instead of playing ball and trying to craft language that's acceptable to the United States, that he's actually intervening in the United Nations and asking questions of the relevance of the United Nations itself. Is that about right?
Well, you know, he's on record questioning the relevance of the United Nations and talking about, you know, at one time lopping off 10 floors of the building. And one has to ask the question if they're setting up the UN to fail so he can justify his, you know, comments about cutting down the building.
Now, there's a coalition that's formed. Who's in the coalition that's going to oppose Bolton's initiative here?
Well, you mean among civil society or among governments?
Both.
Well, the governments are organized regionally. As you probably know, the European Union tries to speak with one voice. The developing countries come together in a regional bloc, and there are other subsets. What's been challenging about the summit is because it does address so many different issues, each regional bloc has a different priority. So, for example, for the European Union, the Human Rights Council and the Peacebuilding Commission are top priorities. For a lot of the developing countries, increasing development assistance, debt forgiveness is a top priority, which is why throwing a monkey wrench at the last minute makes it very difficult to keep this balance, because I think we all believe that unless it stays together as a package, no one piece will succeed.
But are people unifying against Bolton despite their differences in priorities? Do you find that in an ironic way that Bolton is a unifying force?
I think he is among civil society, definitely. But I'm not sure I could say the same among governments.
I read in the British press that the United Kingdom was going to oppose Bolton's efforts. Have you heard that?
I hope they do.
Now, also, it's been revealed that a formerly internal document of the United Nations on food for oil has been leaked, and it appears to somehow be timed with bringing into question Kofi Annan's credibility and his ability to maybe get this particular summit to a success. What do you think?
Well, there's been a lot of rumors that the next Oil for Food report is going to come out right before the summit and that it will undermine Kofi Annan's credibility. You know, we certainly hope that there isn't any criminal action or something that would show his involvement in a negative way. But there have been rumors like that at the UN for a long time, so it's hard to know for sure what's going to happen. I think we can say, and actually we're just about to send a letter to the Secretary General and the President of the General Assembly, signed by women's groups all over the world, asking them to take stronger leadership on women's rights and gender equality issues, because the last 2 months or so, most of the discussions have been going on between the governments without the at least active, visible involvement of the Secretary General. And he obviously and the institution have a lot at stake, and his leadership is needed.
I believe the Volcker report is due to come out on September 6th. Now, if Kofi Annan is injured by the Food for Oil report, is he necessary for a successful summit despite Bolton's aggressive tactics?
Well, I think the problem is, where is the leadership coming from? And that's why when you said, you know, the United Kingdom is going to oppose Bolton, and I said, I hope so, it's because the United Kingdom has the presidency of the European Union during this period. And, of course, at the G8 summit, they didn't very successfully oppose the positions of the United States and didn't make the kind of gains they had hoped to make. So we believe that the European Union and the United Kingdom have a different perspective, and we really are strongly encouraging them to hold fast to that. But right now, it's not clear where that strong leadership will actually come from, other than from the President of the General Assembly, who's being, you know, battered by all sides for all different reasons.
Now, Ms. Zeitlin, we have about a minute and a half left. What can Americans do? I mean, for half our nation, we are seemingly held captive by the Bush administration and their hostility towards diplomatic international peaceful relations. So what can we do?
I actually think there's a lot that Americans can do, because even though half of the people in the country didn't vote for the Bush administration, they do, you know, are supposed to represent all of us, and it's really important that they hear from people who don't agree with them. So they could send emails to the U.S. mission to the United Nations, to John Bolton, telling them exactly what they think about this strategy. They could send them to the White House, and they could send them to the Secretary of State. Okay. Bolton does report to the Secretary of State.
Do you have that first email address by chance to the U.N. mission?
It would be Bolton at state.gov, G-O-V.
Bolton at state.gov. Any closing thoughts in the last 30 seconds?
Well, this summit is really important to the women of the world, particularly the poorest, because the United Nations is the only of the global institutions that really focuses on development. Commitments have been made, and when the world leaders gather, who are mostly men, it's really important that they remember that most of the poor are women, and women do know how to make change and are agents of change themselves.
Okay.
And we want to make sure that gets heard when the summit gathers.
June Zeitlin, we're going to have to wrap it up here. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much with the Women's Environment and Development Organization. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness.
Folks, thanks again. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Show. This is Scott Forster filling in for Tom Hartman. Thank you, Tom, wherever you are. I'm going to talk a little bit about the mighty Mississippi. My focus as a radio guy here in the Portland, Oregon area for about 10-plus years, I've done an environmental show called Monday on the Environment. And what I'm hearing immediately in the aftermath of the hurricane is that the Corps of Engineers failed to do their job because the funds were going to Iraq. And that's true, and I'm not quibbling with that. And that is a good point to make about the Bush administration focusing so much on Iraq that we're not taking care of the homeland. Homeland security is not just defense in a military sense, but also a defense against natural disasters such as hurricanes. But the one thing that occurred to me that might not be readily of ready interest to the media anyway is the fact that the war on the mighty Mississippi has been going on for 100 years. And what do I mean by that is that the loss of wetlands and barrier islands in the Mississippi Delta, which have a protective effect when it comes to hurricanes and storms, has been so greatly diminished that the effect of these hurricanes are much greater. New Orleans has been there for hundreds of years and has been through many hurricanes. Even prior to statistical keeping, it has been conjectured that there has been several hurricanes of this size in the New Orleans area, but have not wreaked this kind of havoc. Obviously, the population was different. But as of the last 20 or 30 years, particularly, the offshore oil wells, the oil companies to access that have carved these deep canals to take their service equipment to the platforms. And these act as canal channels that channel the water quickly away from the wetlands and drains the wetlands. The wetlands act as a natural sponge, and the mighty Mississippi in its natural acts will fan out in the Great Delta fan and over thousands and thousands of acres gently deposit its tons and tons of sediment. This sediment builds up and not only creates life for the ecosystems, but also creates a natural barrier that then makes the New Orleans and the other parishes in the area impervious to the destructive effects of the hurricane. So that, I think, is something that's been missing. And I've been talking to folks around the nation, especially people from the Blue Frontier Foundation. We have David Helvarg, who wrote a book, War Against the Greens, and also, I believe, recently Blue Frontier. And he is absolutely an expert on this, and I've had him on my program before. And we'll see if that's going to get eventually covered by the media. So while we're trying to do a war on Iraq, we've made a war on the Mississippi, and I think perhaps we should rethink that. Now, in the time remaining here, we've got a phone caller here, and I'm going to go ahead and take Mike from D.C. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am. How you doing?
Yeah, what's your question? How you doing?
Okay, just wanted to point out, I lived down in New Orleans for about 4 years. I know the area quite well. They actually had a plan on the board to reinvigorate the wetlands because they were losing them, and because the wetlands do provide a buffer of sorts against things like hurricanes. And that plan had to be scrapped because it was, quote, too expensive. It would have cost less than 2 months operations in Iraq.
Yeah,
And now they have an entire city that's been lost.
Well, we're going to be picking through the ashes, so to speak, of this disaster like we're going to be picking through the ashes of the Iraqi disaster. This Bush administration is an unnatural disaster.
Correct.
Well, good. We're both in agreement. I appreciate you calling in today.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Now, we're going to be heading off to a break here soon, folks. And I wanted to let you know it's a pleasure filling in here for Tom Hartman today. And hopefully in the future, you'll be able to hear more from me. Now, folks, take care, and I'll see you shortly.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What was it you wanted? Tell me again so I know. What's happening in there? What's going on in your show? What was it you wanted? Could you say it again? I'll be back in a minute. You can get it together by then.
Yes, folks, thank you for joining the Tom Hartman Show. I'm your temporary co-host, Scott Forster, actually hosting in for Tom. Thank you, Tom Hartman. Now, we're going to be looking for another guest here coming up shortly. When we get him on the line, it'll be David Swanson, who's the media coordinator with the International Labor Communications Association. And we're going to be talking about the Downing Street Memo and Cindy Sheehan. David Swanson, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me. Also, I switch jobs quite frequently, and I'm not with the ILCA anymore, but I am with the peace movement and after Downing Street and some other places.
Okay, so a multitasker at different hats.
Yes.
Well, now, what's happening with the Downing Street memo now that there's so many things going on, and with the Hurricane Katrina, we are seemingly things that are important are not important anymore, or are they?
Well, I think it's all connected and it's important, and if you send all the National Guard to Iraq to fight for oil so you can produce more global warming and then disasters hit and you got nobody to help out, you know, it all kind of ties together as one huge disaster of a presidency. But the Downing Street memos, you know, we held hearings back in June, Congressman Conyers did, and Cindy Sheehan spoke, and this was before Cindy had become the media phenomenon that she has now, and we saw some progress. And more recently, Congresswoman Barbara Lee has introduced a resolution of inquiry, saying, "Give us the information from this side of the ocean from 3 years ago of what the Bush administration was planning, so we can know whether we were being lied to, as all the evidence from the UK suggests." And quite an extensive pile of other evidence as well. And that resolution of inquiry will be voted on between September 6th and September 16th in the International Relations Committee. And it's looking very likely that we could actually pass it, that all of the Democrats will vote for it. And if we have three Republicans, we'll be set. And we have one, which is Congressman Jim Leach. Another who's on the committee who seems likely is Congressman Ron Paul, and Cindy Sheehan is meeting with him tomorrow, so we'll see if she can persuade him.
Now, Congressman Ron Paul is from where?
From Texas.
Uh-huh. And this is HRES 375?
That's correct, yes.
And you say somewhere between what dates is it going to be voted on?
Well, September 6th is when Congress comes back from vacation, and September 16th is the date on which this resolution has to be acted on, or the sponsor can demand a vote of the full House, and that the Republicans will never allow that.
I see. But you're saying it might actually pass out. Now, you mentioned two Republicans. The Dems are probably going to go for it. Who would be the third Republican? Do we have an idea?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it can't be just anyone, but it has to be someone on the International Relations Committee.
And do you know the Republicans on those committees now?
Sure. I mean, there are, you know, about 20, 28 Republicans on the committee. Ron Paul seems the most likely because he voted for Congresswoman Woolsey's amendment demanding an exit strategy a couple months ago,
mm-hmm.
and he's co-sponsoring Congressman Kucinich and Abercrombie's bill, you know, rather weak sort of bill for an exit strategy, start getting out in October of 2006, but he seems like a possibility. And you know, these bus tours left Camp Casey this morning, and Cindy Sheehan is on one of them and is meeting with Congressman Lloyd Doggett today, and with Congressman Ron Paul, and if possible, Tom DeLay tomorrow. So that should be interesting.
Is Congressman Doggett also from Texas?
Yes, but he is not on the International Relations Committee, so he doesn't help with this particular right. resolution.
So now, do you have the itinerary of Cindy Sheehan as she travels to Washington, D.C.?
Well, there are three buses leaving Camp Casey and heading for Washington, D.C., and Cindy will be on one of them through Friday, after which she has all sorts of prior speaking engagements that were scheduled before this ever happened, before she ever went to Crawford. And so she won't be on any of the three buses for most of that time. But by the 23rd of September, she and everyone else will be in Washington, D.C. But to see where the buses are going and whether you can get involved and one's coming to your town, you can go to our website, afterdowningstreet.org, and click on the right-hand side on the bus tour. And there's also another link that went up there today called Meet with the Mothers, which is a campaign that every organization involved is part of that is trying to get people to meet with their own Congress members around the country and ask the questions that Cindy has been asking.
I've visited your site, and I think it's a great resource. Now, tell folks out there what's happening on the other side of the pond, in the UK with Downing Street. Is it all forgotten?
Oh, absolutely not. It's not all forgotten at all. There is a group called Military Families Against the War and a group called the Stop the War Coalition, and we're in frequent contact with them. An organizer from this side of the pond from California, former legislator Tom Hayden, is taking a trip over there to meet with them and plan some strategy. And they are actually taking a suit to the International Criminal Court against Tony Blair because, you know, they, not just Blair, but Bush as well, violated international law quite flagrantly in launching this aggressive war. And military families from over there who lost their sons and daughters in Iraq, just as Cindy Sheehan did, are taking the matter to court. And it will be interesting to see where that goes. And, you know, in addition, they're doing the activism that we are doing, and they will have a huge protest on September 24th. Just as we will in Washington.
That's going to be great to see, and hopefully the press will actually be there. Now, what's the timing on this International Criminal Court?
You know, I don't know. It's a very slow process.
So it's something that's going to take a while to evolve. Now, that's because the United Kingdom is a signatory to the International Court. Is that right?
That's correct, whereas the U.S. is not. However, there is a law from 1996 that makes it U.S. law to follow any conventions that, around human rights that the U.S. is party to. So violating the Geneva Conventions, which President Bush has done quite blatantly, is actually a violation of U.S. law. It's just very difficult in this country to get anyone to care, anyone in power.
Has there been a move to try to get legal counsel to launch a lawsuit along those lines?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, we have been pushing more strongly in the direction of impeachment because for the president to lie to Congress is a felony and a high crime and an impeachable offense. And, you know, the president sent a formal letter to Congress on March 18th, 2003, saying here are the reasons why the war is necessary. And he said the threat of Iraq's weapons and, you know, the backing of the 9/11 attacks, you know, both of which he knew at the time to be lies and which we have extensive evidence to document. And the problem is that the Democrats are afraid to try to impeach him.
You've noticed.
Yes, you know, you meet with them in person, the most progressive representatives of the people we've got, and they're literally afraid. They physically shake. They do not want the Republicans to attack them for attacking the president.
Well, that's why we're here on the radio and why folks in civil society need to pick up the flag, and maybe the political leaders will follow. Now, folks out there, I'm listening, or you're listening to David Swanson, and he wears many hats, but after Downingstreet.org is one of them. And my name is Scott Forster, filling in for Tom Hartman. So there might be some confusion out there. Some people think we sound alike. I just don't think so, but it's a pleasure to be here. Now, moving on to this, the idea of the litigation, I'm thinking strategically that it'd be nice to have the litigation under the 1996 law that says that even under U.S. federal law, we must follow the Geneva Conventions, international treaties. The idea is that it might get some publicity while you're working that way through the court, because the impeachment articles have to originate in the House, and that's not going to happen until there's a Democratic majority in 2006.
It certainly looks that way. You know, obviously the Republicans never hesitated to propose impeachment, whether they were in the minority or not. They sort of made clear to people what they'd be getting if they voted them into a majority. The Democrats think the other way. They think until we're in a majority, we can't do anything. And I reply, well, then you're not going to be in a majority. But we'll see. It may be that this president has become so awful that people will vote for the Democrats even without a clear vision for what the Democrats are. But, you know, in terms of the lawsuit that you're suggesting, the group that's been pushing that angle most strongly for the longest period of time is Veterans for Peace. And you can go to the website of Veterans for Peace, and these are veterans of the Iraq War and other wars, and see what they're up to. But as far as I know, there's not a suit that's actually been filed.
Now, the September 24th, how do you envision this coming together? It appears that there is this great timing. Just in general, people are starting to wake up on many avenues. I think even Hurricane Katrina is in it going to show that Bush's domestic policy is so horrible that it's going to then show further light on his international policy. What do you envision happening in D.C.? Is this going to be historic?
It's going to be absolutely enormous. You know, there are going to be buses traveling from around the country bringing thousands and thousands of people to D.C. for days of events. You know, there will be a number of related events on the 23rd, including a Congressional Black Caucus event. On the 24th will be the huge march, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And the 25th, there will be all kinds of workshops and events and trainings and preparation. And on the 26th, something that many of these groups have never done before, and that is trying to work with Congress. Thousands of people will be going on lobby visits prepared with appropriate information and follow-through, and thousands of others will be engaging in civil disobedience. This is on the 26th. And then still more events on the 27th. And so this will be a huge, huge onslaught in the nation's capital of, you know, the sort of thing you don't see around here too much, democracy. And it will be very interesting to see. You know, this is not unprecedented. There were major marches against this war before there was even the war, but the media didn't pay much attention. Now the media is sort of telling us that a movement has been born. You know, well, it hasn't been born, but if they want to start covering it now, that's great.
It's been born to CNN and Fox.
Right, exactly. And we can thank Cindy for that primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see what it means in terms of media coverage, and whether, you know, there are three guys who light something on fire and throw a rock and that's the whole media coverage, or whether the hundreds of thousands of people peacefully marching with serious demands.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem like that this particular era is really as violent as Vietnam. And I was young then, but the idea, there was a lot of perceived violence or agitation between the parties. Here, everything seems to be still very opinionated and divided, but so far relatively peaceful, especially on the anti-war side or peace side. And I'm looking forward to a march that is huge, passionate, and peaceful. And I wanted to also see if you'd be willing to stay with us after the break.
Sure.
Well, great. We got about a minute and a half. And so what can folks do? How would they get to Washington, D.C. if they wanted to? What are the resources? And then also, is there things going on locally?
Well, you can go to afterdowningstreet.org, and there are links to all of this. One of the links is to unitedforpeace.org, which is the website of United for Peace and Justice. And you can sign up there on a ride board. You can sign up to find somebody who has a couch you can sleep on. You can sign up to do the lobbying on that Monday, the 26th. There's all kinds of resources. It's a huge effort. I should mention also on September 15th there will be a smaller rally at the White House for those relatively local who can make it because that day Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey is holding hearings on an exit strategy, which of course is a long time coming and badly needed.
Well, what time is that hearing?
It's likely to be late morning on the 15th, and the rally is at 5 p.m. in front of the White House.
Do you know if C-SPAN will be covering that at all?
I don't know, and I suspect that they have not been asked because the room has not been found and the time has not been fixed. But they will certainly be asked, and whether we make a push for it or not, our activists around the country will flood them with phone calls.
Okay. Well, listen, David, stand by, and we'll come out of the break, and we'll be taking your calls and questions, folks. So call in at 1-866-889-8894. That's 1-866-889-8894. This is Scott Forster filling in for the Tom Hartman Show.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Here they come again. Catch us if you can. Time to get a move on.
It's time to get a move on with my clicking of the right buttons. Folks, this is Scott Forster filling in for the Tom Hartman Show. Thanks, Tom. Quick on the draw. Still have a guest here, David Swanson, who is with AfterDowningStreet.org, among other hats that he's wearing. David, thanks for hanging on over the break. What's happening with the bus tour, Cindy Sheehan and others? This is not just about Cindy Sheehan. This is now a full-fledged peace movement.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Camp Casey broke up this morning down in Crawford, Texas, and three bus tours and caravans headed out in different directions. One of them headed north through Oklahoma, one of them headed over to Arkansas, and one was planned to head to Houston and New Orleans and so on. And I asked Cindy this morning whether the storm was changing the plans, and she said, well, as little as possible. They're going to go as far as they can because they have all sorts of supplies to donate to people down there. And I might just note that our president is not down there yet and seems to be moving in the other direction. But Cindy is going to meet with Congress members on one of those bus tours over the next couple of days and then has other engagements. But the buses will be traveling around the country through the red states, stopping at Congress members' offices and demanding an end to this war.
Now, are you going to be in Washington, D.C.?
I was born and raised and live in Washington, D.C., so I don't have to do anything to get here, but everybody else is going to come to my house.
Now, what is AfterDowningStreet.org, are you going to be reporting as a news reporter what's happening from your perspective, or is there a site that's going to be the site to go to?
Well, the big overall coalition site that's behind this is United for Peace and Justice.
And their website address?
UnitedForPeace.org. UnitedForPeace.org. They are an enormous coalition, and we're part of it and promoting it. Yes, absolutely, After Downing Street will have up-to-date blogs and photos and videos going on. So will PDAmerica.org, Progressive Democrats of America, which is doing all sorts of events as part of this.
Well, David, thank you very much. David Swanson, AfterDowningStreet.org, among other things, I thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, thank you for joining me today, the Tom Hartman Show. I'm your temporary host, Scott Forster. It's been a pleasure, a little bit nerve-wracking, but it is definitely something that makes me very happy, and I hope to serve you in the future. We'll see. In the meantime, folks, Washington, D.C., September 24th, there's activities before and after. The peace movement, which was fledgling, has now grown its eagle feathers, and it is full-fledged. So stay tuned. Of course, Tom Hartman Show, the chat room, some of the smartest people in the world, and we'll keep talking about these things that are important to you. All right, take care, folks. Thank you. And remember, every day is Earth Day.